Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures and puts them into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Today, we're talking about attorney ethics, the price that some attorneys pay for lying or misleading a court. Is this behavior required in President Trump's new Justice Department? That's one of the questions we will discuss today. Judge Gail, before we get to the current issues, you know, really all of this thing about attorneys lying and so forth really came to fore after the 2020 election. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think it became more pervasive.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
In the public eye, I should say.
Indeed, because let's be clear, you know, lying to the court is not something new. It certainly has happened before and has happened many times before. But I think seeing it kind of at the levels that we see it and from the spaces that we are seeing it is something that's really different. For example, and you can correct me in your perspective, but I don't know that we've seen judges losing faith, if you will, in the arguments from the state as frequently as we see this telegraphed based on what appears to be the lack of forthrightness with the court, which, by the way, is an ethical obligation.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. But if we look back at that post-2020 election, all the litigation that went on about that, and all of the fraudulent claims that were made to courts, and that's not my term, that's what the courts said they were, fraudulent claims. You know, we have a laundry list of people who were involved in that, who have received disciplinary sanctions. For example, John Eastman was one of the attorneys, a mastermind behind some of the strategies. Mm-hmm. He's been disbarred by the California State Bar. He's appealing that, but he's been disbarred. Rudy Giuliani was disbarred in New York and in Washington, D.C. for making false statements. You've had attorneys suspended. Rudy was suspended. Kenneth Chesbro was suspended in Massachusetts. We've had other.
Was that after he pled in Georgia?
Yeah.
Okay.
We've had other disciplinary actions. Sidney Powell, some people remember her. She avoided disbarment in Texas, but she was sanctioned in Michigan for filing frivolous lawsuits. Jenna Ellis, you might remember her. Mm-hmm. Colorado judge censured her for making false claims about the election. And the infamous Jeffrey Clark, the guy who was intended to be attorney general in the first Trump administration, a D.C. bar committee found he violated at least one ethics rule in lying about election fraud. Mm-hmm. So if we broke that down, all of the post-election, it really came down to two things. And I wanted us to talk about those two things, if we could, Judge Gail. One is making false statements, but the other one is making or bringing about frivolous lawsuits. Mm. Both are attacks on credibility of the attorneys. Both are have been determined to be ethical violations. So let's talk about the frivolous lawsuits first. What do you think that means? How can we explain that to people?
Well, I think we can probably, in layman's term, explain frivolous lawsuits as being, you know, one of two things. First, you can bring multiple lawsuits, essentially, you know, looking to rellitigate the same thing even after the court has spoken to that issue
over and over again.
So, I mean, this is more than just asking the court to reconsider, right? Or to, you know, give it another shot or to take another look at it, but consistently, constantly bringing back the same thing, knowing the court has been very clear about its decision and its position on this same issue. So there not being a lot of difference in what that refiling is, and essentially just, you know, photocopying it and bringing it back over and over again. That is considered frivolous, but also filing lawsuits that have no merit or lack truthfulness.
What do you mean by that? Because I've got a definition, but I want to hear yours.
So lacking merit means there's no legal basis or there's no factual basis. So there's nothing to firm up this complaint or this lawsuit that is supported by either the facts or the law. And so nothing for the court to decide, essentially.
It's filing a lawsuit where there's no supportive evidence, mm-hmm. Supportive evidence to back up the claims in the lawsuit. It's just, you know, claiming something without any backup, as far as evidence or facts.
Correct. And so, and my definition of filing frivolous lawsuits would fall into one of those camps.
Okay, so that is...
Did I miss one?
No, I think you're spot on.
Okay.
But I think that's an ethical violation and really caused problems for a lot of these attorneys. Some of these attorneys, that was the reason that they were... brought to in front of disciplinary counsel is the fact that they just kept filing the same lawsuit over and over in sometimes the same jurisdiction.
Indeed. Now, I just want to pause for the benefit of our listeners and say it is not uncommon for someone to file a lawsuit and for the court to hear that case and to hear the evidence about that case and to make a decision, and for the unhappy party, so the person who didn't get the ruling in their favor, for the unhappy party to then come back and say, "Judge, can you think about that again? Or Judge, will you consider that again? Or Judge, will you look at this situation again?" Or depending upon who the decision maker was, if there was perhaps a magistrate in the court or a hearing officer, and the party wasn't satisfied with that decision, they could then ask the judge to review the decision of that magistrate or that hearing officer and to potentially substitute their judgment for that. So I want listeners to be really clear. Now, that's not terribly uncommon. However, what is uncommon and what is the issue here is when the judge has spoken and has said, "This is the court's ruling. This is what I find. This is what has been determined. These are the reasons why that is. And based upon that, this is the court's order." And then for the losing party or the unhappy party to continue to keep filing the same thing over and over and over again, kind of frustrating the court and frustrating the process for everybody that's involved. Therein lies the problem. So I don't want to dissuade anyone from thinking that they can't ever ask a court to reconsider their decision. It is, I think what you're saying, Judge Tom, is when you keep going back after the court has been very clear and emphatic about what their position is and how they've ruled, and you keep telling them, no, you got to do it again. And they're like, mm-mm.
So as judge, I say, you have no evidence. The case is dismissed. You have no evidence. They file the case again. What's your evidence? Same. You have no evidence. No. The case is dismissed. That becomes a frivolous lawsuit.
And it's also a level of dishonesty, right? Because what you're kind of suggesting to the court by filing it again is that there's at least something slightly new or different between the first and the second filing, or the second and there's third not. Or whatever. And there is no difference.
Well, that's one area that came about after the 2020 election. And then the other was making false statements to the court. And if we can stay on the 2020 election, then we'll move forward. You know, those were statements about widespread voter fraud or voting irregularities that just flat out did not happen. So attorneys are not allowed to make false or misleading statements to the court. Mm-hmm. You can argue a case, but you can't make a false statement or misleading statement. How would you define that?
Lying. In a word.
Okay. In a word.
Lying. Yes. And everybody knows what lying is. So a lie is a lie is a lie. And by the way, folks, lies don't have colors. So there's no such thing as a white lie versus a black lie versus a purple lie versus a green lie. A lie is a lie is a lie. Now, it is true that some lies have more or deeper or higher impact than others, but false or misleading statements of any type are still lies. Now, again, the magnitude of that might affect a case differently, but a false or misleading statement of any nature is still a lie.
But let's differentiate a lie between, how do I put this? As a criminal defense attorney, when I was in that position, I would make arguments to the court that I didn't believe, but they weren't lies. Do you see what I mean? I would advocate for my client in my client's position, but I wouldn't lie to the court, but I would, I had a legal obligation to make an argument to the court.
And what
Wasn't lying. It was, I was trying to get my powers of persuasion to go my way. Internally, I might not have believed it, but what I believed didn't matter.
I absolutely agree. And so in those instances, what I would consider that is, you know, advocacy perspective, right? It is designed to provide perspective to either to whomever the trier of fact is, so either the jury or the judge, to give them another way of viewing the evidence and to defend the case to them. It doesn't matter if you necessarily believe that that is how things unfolded. Your job is to provide that different vantage point, that different perspective, that defense for the benefit in that zealous advocacy for your client. That I don't consider a lie. What I would consider a lie is literally, you know, a departure from the facts as you know them, and a intentional departure from the facts as you know them, for the purpose of achieving some other end or some other goal. Now, it's one thing to parrot information that you actually believe is true and accurate because that's what's been provided, only to learn later that it is inaccurate or it is untrue, but you were not aware of that. For example, if you are suggesting to the court, no, my client was always home all night because that's what my client told me. That's what my client's wife told me.
My client says he was home all night.
My client says he was home. However,
as opposed to my client was home all night.
Right. Or, you know, you now have surveillance video that shows your client is elsewhere during that time. you relaying to the court that your client was home all night is you, yes, it is an inaccurate statement, but it is, I think intent matters, right? It is an inaccurate statement that is being relayed because that is the information you were provided, when there's, of course, information or evidence to the contrary. I think it's important to acknowledge that, to say, hey, you know, let's test the veracity of it. I don't know where this video came from. It may be accurate. It may not be. I don't know. But it appears that maybe my client wasn't home all night that night. I don't even know if we're talking about the same night. But it is important to make sure that you're clear to say, I'm just relaying the information that I have. But when I think there's a thoughtful, intentional effort to mislead the court, that's just a lie. That's an absolute lie. And I think that adds to an even worse decay in faith in the justice system than more so than just about anything else we've seen.
One thing I think that we need to describe before we come fast forward to 2025 is, as I went through this list of people who've been disbarred or had their license suspended or been censured, I mentioned different states: California, New York, Massachusetts, Texas, Michigan, Colorado. I think we should explain to our listeners that each state has its own set of disciplinary rules for the state courts for attorneys to follow. And if an attorney does not follow those rules within that state, there is a procedure for disciplinary action against that attorney that is only for that state.
Correct.
The federal government has different standards, maybe the same standards, but the different procedure, I should say, where it goes up to disciplinary counsel to a judge.
Or none
if you're a justice. But can you explain why we have so many different rulings? And, you know, most of these things look like they're similar, but there could be a nuance here and there, right?
Yeah, but I think it goes to your point of understanding that lawyers are what are called barred or licensed in their particular states. Now, it is possible to have a law license in multiple states. So you can be licensed to practice or permitted to practice in more than one state. Kind of like, you know, if you think about doctors having licenses to practice, lawyers need licenses to practice.
Those, or you can have reciprocity.
Correct. Which, right, gives you a license without taking a certain exam, or you take a separate exam just for practicing lawyers and not for, you know, newly graduated law students. So those are different, but it's just a path or an avenue to have permission to practice in that court. There's also a special process that allows you to practice in a court that you don't have a license in, as long as you sit with an attorney who does have a license in that state. That's called pro hoc vice.
And oh, so there you go with your Latin again. Whoa, baby.
You can sit with and you can practice in a court. So, for example, I don't have a license to practice in Idaho. And if for some reason I am asked to sit on a case with someone in Idaho or to handle a case in Idaho, I would have to identify an Idaho attorney and ask that attorney to essentially sponsor me for me to sit for that case there. Now, I could also, you know, ask the state of Idaho or the Supreme Court of Idaho to give me a license to practice there. And I would have to research how long it takes to do that. But the quickest way to get it done is to identify someone in the state with a license in that state and sit with them, or essentially be sponsored by or sit under them while they practice with me on that particular case. But that said, it goes back to your point. Each lawyer is licensed to practice in states that have licensed them. But when you agree to accept that license, at the same time, you agree to abide by certain rules of conduct, ethical conduct, and disciplinary conduct that govern your behavior as a lawyer. And understand that your behavior is governed not just in the courtroom. Your behavior is governed. You're always a lawyer, whether you're formally in the courtroom or you're not in the courtroom. So you can't hold a law license and decide to live your life in a way that dishonors it, even if you are not actively practicing in a courtroom at the time. And what you just described was a long list of lawyers who, some of whom were not actually in courtrooms when they engaged in certain behavior. Their behaviors were outside of courtrooms, but they still affected the work of the profession, and it reflected on their work within the profession, which is what triggered the ability of those states' licensing authorities, those Supreme Courts who licensed those lawyers. It triggered their ability to decide whether or not they will allow you to keep that license. Because also remember, each state that licenses an attorney also holds the ability and the authority to decide the terms and conditions on you maintaining that license or relicensing you. Every so often, you have to still go back and prove that you are essentially worthy to maintain your law license. And that's either on a certain cycle, biannually or whatnot, or if you are subject to some kind of disciplinary action, whether it's biannual or not, they don't wait for you to need to renew your license to decide that you're not going to get it. You can lose your law license even before it's up for renewal based on things like disciplinary actions and your behavior.
Well, let's move forward because things are not that great right now on the ethical front with attorneys. And let me try to frame this. We're going to be talking about the rule of law now. We're going to be talking about cases that have not ultimately been decided, but are at various stages with the Trump administration. And the activities of Department of Justice lawyers and U.S. attorneys with courts. And I want to give people a cite here. There was a great article that Judge Gale brought to my attention in Politico, politico.com. It came out on May 6th. The author was a gentleman, and I'm sure I'm going to get this name wrong, Ankush, A-N-K-U-S-H, Kadori, K-H-A-R-D-O-R-I, a senior writer for Politico, a former federal prosecutor at the Department of Justice, who specialized in financial fraud and white-collar crime, wrote a story about the credibility of Department of Justice lawyers and the problems that it's presenting to the court under the rubric of the rule of law and what to do about it. He started off the article, and I thought this was a good point, Judge Gale, that we need to break down, that federal judges deal with federal prosecutors all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
And there was at least in the past, there was degree of trust with those lawyers that what those lawyers said at least was backed up with potential facts. They weren't arguments that were evasive or misleading or lying. In other words, there was a base of good faith in the past. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I'd agree with that, and also agree with the idea that the fact that the Justice Department and its prosecutors having, in addition to all of the other resources, the vast resources that it has, one of the things and most important assets and resources, well, assets that it has in coming into any courtroom would be the credibility.
You're representing, you're Gail Williams Byers for the United States of America.
Yeah.
You know, that has some credibility.
A lot of credibility that, and mind you, I don't bring that, I would not be bringing that credibility under my name only, right? That's not because I've done anything. It is because over the many, many, many years that the DOJ has done the work that it has done, you know, they have built up this kind of stockpile of goodwill and credibility and fair dealing and good faith. And yes, it's also coupled with a potentially and stunningly high rate of convictions, successful convictions in cases such that, you know, I'd always say it ain't never good news when the feds come knocking.
Right.
And so and you know this, you know this because of their high 90 percentile conviction rate. And that is because of that marriage of those vast resources, but also because of the thoroughness which with which prosecutors are known to do their work and the manner in which and professionalism with which they carry themselves and how they navigate the courthouse, as well as the consistency with which they deal with judges, right? They sometimes deal with the same defense attorneys, but the level of consistency that they deal with judges such that the judges know what they can and what they should expect from dealing with the prosecutors begins with forthrightness, right? It begins with honoring their oath to their office. It starts with understanding and appreciating that the federal government respects and appreciates all these resources they bring, but they also bring them in a way that still respects the rule of law. It respects the court, but it's also, it respects the process. And perhaps the most important sign of respect to the process is truthfulness.
Let me read a paragraph from this article because I think it stage sets what we want to talk about from this point forward. This is a quote from the article. In the first few months of President Donald Trump's second term, Justice Department lawyers have come under fire from judges across the country in some of the most high-profile cases that have emerged since his inauguration. The comments have been unusually sharp, at times directly questioning the honesty of the government's lawyers and the accuracy of their factual claims. And taken together, they suggest that the administration's officials are squandering the department's credibility just when they need it the most. What's your response to that?
Stunning. It's stunning because here we're at a time when we see the Justice Department. And again, to some degree, I will say, you know, whether we like it or not, it is a function of a democracy. When you elect a new president, the new president imprints on the federal government and kind of articulates and dictates the priorities of that administration. And that has a way to permeate through every agency within United States government. And now, yes, traditionally, the U.S. Department of Justice had been, you know, maybe one of the exceptions to the rule because of its necessary entanglement with the Justice Department and the need to kind of separate that, or at least the perception of using the executive branch as a retributive tool against its own people. But again, although that had been the historical And seemingly, I don't know if that was the case in during the McCarthy era, but you know, or the Hoover era, quite frankly. But I know that insofar as, you know, in modern society, we kind of perceive the Department of Justice as being kind of distinct and separate from the executive branch. The executive certainly maintains the ability to, and it's absolutely exercising it here, the ability to imprint on the Department of Justice and to kind of, you know, indicate and dictate what the priorities of the Justice Department will be. And whether you like it, love it, or hate it, that is just the way it is. That said, even in all of that, I do believe that there's a lot to be said for what the Justice Department does while shifting priorities and deciding how it will respond to and how it will align with the priorities of the administration, and how it will do that still within its responsibilities as lawyers. And in this one paragraph that you read that talked about how it is essentially squandering the one of the most important assets it has, which is credibility with the court. We're at a time where we're seeing this same Justice Department bring some of the most important cases of a generation to the courts. Everything from birthright citizenship to issues around immigration and the like. These are all so important.
Bringing Mr. Garcia back from
El Salvador. Yes. Well, and again, that goes to, and that's actually, I think, you know, is an issue of whether or not the U.S. maintains constructive possession of an individual. And that, I think, it may be a whole nother podcast episode. But
right.
In my view, where the government has signed a contract and has paid money to a third party, and I don't care who that third party is, to maintain, you know, a physical structure and possession of individuals pursuant to that contract, it does not then relinquish all of its obligations, because the government would presumably maintain some form of constructive possession under those circumstances. And that would be my thinking, as I would hear, you know, and I would be incredulous in listening to DOJ try to explain how the federal government has no obligation under those circumstances. So we give money away, we dump people away, and we have no obligation after that. That just seems, especially after we've now admitted to making a mistake, that seems incredible to me.
Let me highlight some areas that were brought forth in this article that I think are noteworthy. They talk about in March alone, there were four different judges who really laid into Justice Department lawyers. There was a judge in California who said that the attorneys were using a sham strategy.
Oh, that is such, that's terse language.
yeah. To fire probationary federal employees by falsely claiming that the dismissals were the result of poor performance. The judge said, "I tend to doubt that you're telling me the truth." Mm. That was said to the lawyer. Same day, another judge handling a challenge to firings said that what the government's saying just isn't true.
Wow.
You know? And then a third, the next one, the fourth one, no, I guess it's the third one, I'm sorry. On a transgender case, the judge said the government's arguments were littered with animus and pretext. You're saying one thing to the public, you're saying a different thing to the court.
Can I pause you there and ask you, would you ever talk to an attorney like that? I mean, I'm just saying, and if you did, what do you think it would take to make you use
I would have that to kind be of language? I would have to be provoked that this person is not going to do what I ordered them to do. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to do it because they're going to twist everything that's said to their benefit, and they're showing that by making these specious arguments to me.
And so would you ever tell a lawyer that, you know, essentially, I sincerely doubt that what you're saying is the truth? That to me is just, I'm just shocked that any judge got to a point where they would actually say that and put that on the record. And I would think that really took a level of a frustration.
Oh, yeah. To get to that point. The other one in March, the judge said that the lawyers were using speculation, innuendo, and basic legal disagreements. She went on to say that what they said sounded like a talking point from a member of Congress rather than a legal brief to the United States from the United States Department of Justice. Those are crushing comments
from
judges, and the judges are. Let me just say this: I'm not saying who appointed the judges because it doesn't matter. But I will say these are judges from across the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
These are not, oh, as we commonly say, these are not just Obama judges, you know, or Biden judges or whatever. These are judges from across the political spectrum. You know, this is a currency that is being squandered in an unethical way.
And it's a necessary currency that I think they need to hold on to. That, again, given the nature, the magnitude, the gravity, the seriousness of the cases that are continuing to be brought, that credibility, truthfulness, that again, that currency of truthfulness and fair dealing and being forthright with the court is absolutely a currency that lawyers, and these lawyers in particular, cannot afford to lose.
Well, that was just March. In April,
that's 1 month.
In April, things got worse. A judge said that the arguments of Department of Justice attorney were pretextual and unsubstantiated. In another case, that they were just trying to muddy the waters. A judge saying that you're trying to muddy the waters. In the Garcia case, the judge said that the government was willful and in bad faith, refused to comply with court order. It just went on. There are a couple others here, replete with conclusions, declarations, and accusations, completely and wholly unsubstantiated by anything meaningful in the record. Wow.
That is, and again, to hear those types of statements, and here's what I also say.
From learned people. I mean, these
from
judges.
Learned judges.
These aren't your local justice of the peace hack, perhaps. No, these are federal judges that have been vetted through at least some process.
I do agree. And although I would say that even JOPs could be extremely learned, but I would also go as far as to say, I sincerely doubt that these were the first hearings as well. So it at least appears to some degree that these were, part of hearing series, if you will, meaning this had perhaps been maybe the, you know, second or third or maybe even fourth hearing on this issue. But the level of and type of articulated frustration that appears to be obvious here is it's just something to behold. It's incredible when you hear it.
In the Garcia case, this really started in the situation where the government attorney said to the court, "We made a mistake. There was no reason to take Mr. Garcia. We were in error." And that attorney got fired.
I was going to say, I think that attorney probably was sanctioned. And I didn't know if they were fired or placed on administrative leave, but I would believe that.
It was like being put back on the beat if you were a cop, you know.
or at the, you know, back in my days of being a prosecutor, a local prosecutor, we'd say whenever you made a mistake or an error that was that egregious, your next assignment was to guard a dumpster.
You know, this guy's probably guarding a dumpster in North Dakota, you know. but for telling the truth,
yeah.
He was sanctioned.
So you're punished for the currency you need to preserve. And I don't know that there are penalties. Well, I don't know that there are penalties within the agency for this kind of behavior, but I think that the penalties that attorneys could face with regard to their careers, the penalties attorneys could face with regard to what happens, you know, to them within this case, you know, and long-term, and also disciplinary penalties. I mean, I suspect, you know, the Rudy Giulianis of the world never dreamed that they would lose their law license for, you know, for what happened back in 2020. Probably never saw that coming. But nonetheless, just, you know, kind of barreled toward that as an end goal. And I don't know that even in this instance, these attorneys are thinking about their own livelihoods. Because I'll tell you, I would always say my license is my livelihood. Protecting my license is so important. And, you know, for them, it at least appears that, you know, it's not as important to be truthful, forthcoming, fair dealing with the court as it is to, you know, maybe, you know, ensure that your agency is happy with your response and that you, you know, push back against the court, even if that results in disciplinary action down the road. And that's, I don't know what kind of bargaining you have to go through in your mind in order to be okay with that. I can tell you, I probably would not be okay with that.
So disciplinary action, as we talked about as we started this episode, still could happen to these attorneys who are misleading the court.
Oh, yeah. Lying
to the court. But we also talked a couple episodes ago about contempt. Mm-hmm. The attorney also could be held in contempt of court for lying or misleading the court, or for directing their client not to follow an order of the court, correct?
Indeed. And so, in order to deal with the contempt, you can purge it by apologizing or correcting the record, but that might result in job loss. Or you can never purge the contempt, and you can have that.
Or guarding the dumpster in North Dakota, right?
Yeah. Or you can never purge the contempt and be... you know, required to kind of live with it on your professional record and any other sanctions that come along with it, which is less than ideal, because I think most lawyers really do honor the work they do. They, you know, they want to spend their career. I don't know anybody who's like, you know what, my goal as a lawyer is to be disciplined as many times as possible and to escape it. I will tell you, for me personally, when I have had experiences when, you know, either as I don't know that I've ever had complaints filed against me as a practitioner, as a prosecutor, as a lawyer, but as a judge, I frequently faced frivolous complaints filed against me, largely from, you know, the inept administration in the city that I was in at the, you know, and I'm sure at the behest of the mayor of that community. But I've faced frivolous complaints filed against me for disciplinary reasons that were completely unfounded, meritless. And even though those had to be defended, at the end of the day, the thing that always, you know, bothered me was, you know, I knew that it lacked merit. I knew that there was never truth to it. I knew that, you know, they trafficked in lies and that was actually just, you know, part of their DNA. But at the end of the day, I never wanted any of that to be reflected on my professional record as a lawyer, as a judge, as a member of this profession, because I honor the profession just that much. And I honor the work that I do just that much. that I'd be doggone if I was going to spend this many years in this work and have somebody essentially sully my reputation by, you know, alleging that I've engaged in something that did not reflect or reflected poorly on the profession itself. And that's what this does. Lying reflects poorly on the profession. And I don't know a lawyer who actually, you know, would celebrate that being the case, unless you're Jim Carrey in the movie Liar Liar, and that was kind of his calling card. But I don't know anyone who just says, hey, yeah, sign me up for that, because I'm perfectly fine with being called, I'm okay with being called a liar, and I'm okay with disrespecting the court, and I'm okay with having, you know, all of these blemishes on my professional record as a lawyer. And it's okay if only a few people respect me because I'm more interested in being paid than I am in being respected. To me, that's kind of everything we don't stand for.
Well, we do have an example of a disciplinary action that is coming about, and that involves the Justice Department official, Ed Martin, who
that name sounds familiar.
He's been serving as U.S. attorney in D.C. on an interim basis. Mm-hmm. He's under investigation by the ethics office. He disclosed that in his parting shot. He is now going to head a task force on weaponization of the Justice Department. But he's not going to be a U.S. attorney. That his nomination has been withdrawn. President Trump appointed Jeanine Pirro from Fox News, who was an elected judge way back when. Mm-hmm. And she's now going to take over the D.C. U.S. attorney position.
And that's another episode, too, because that's an interesting yes. transition. That the statute is 120 days. I think they got to 119 days. And the question is whether or not this, you know, can keep happening, you know, every 119 days or so, or if there's a judicial appointment that needs to happen after the first, you know, 120 days or so. Not sure, but I'd love to see how this works out.
So this goes to credibility of attorneys, credibility of the Department of Justice, mm-hmm. not necessarily lying or misleading, but this is another aspect. Apparently, Martin has been charged with allegedly using the threat of prosecution to intimidate and chill speech of perceived adversaries, such as lawmakers, protesters, journalists, medical journals, and others, he said, oppose the agenda of President Donald Trump or billionaire advisor Elon Musk, even in instances when they did not commit a crime, but, quote, acted simply unethically, end quote. And this is from the Washington Post on May 15th.
You know, that's so interesting that you mentioned, you know, the threat of prosecution, because I think it reminds our audience of the power of the DOJ and the power of prosecutors, whether they're federal or local. And they do wield an awful lot of power. And ethically speaking, and this is, it reminds me of a fight that I had, and it's since resolved, so I'm happy to talk about it. It's a fight that I had with the city of South Euclid when I was fighting them over how they were dealing with something as simple as parking tickets. And the city worked with the former judge and the police chief at the time, and they would literally issue citations to people, and they would tell them essentially, if you pay, then, you know, we'll be fine. But if you don't pay a certain amount, then we will prosecute you, kind of using the power and the threat of prosecution to shake people down for money. And similar to what you said about the allegations or the disciplinary complaint with Mr. Martin, ethically, you cannot use the threat of prosecution to coerce someone to do or not do something. Either you're going to prosecute or you're not going to prosecute, but you cannot use the power of that office to coerce somebody to either pay money or not pay money, to do an act or not do an act, to go somewhere, to do something or fail to do something. And this was something that the city that I was in South Euclid, they were really upset because it really shut down this whole process of how they were actually prosecuting something as simple as parking ticket cases, because for years they'd essentially been fleecing their own residents and college students and everyone else by essentially forcing them to pay or threatening to prosecute them. And it sounds like the allegations here with Mr. Martin are kind of similar, that, you know, if you don't do something, then you may be threatened with prosecution using the power of that office and the power of prosecutors.
Mm-hmm, the abuse that. Of the abuse of the office.
It is. It's absolutely abusive.
Mm-hmm. The abuse of the office, but it's also another aspect of this credibility umbrella that we've been talking about. Filing frivolous lawsuits, mm-hmm. lying, misleading the court, failing to follow court orders, and now threatening prosecutions that are unwarranted and untoward.
Unethical. It was so bad in South Euclid, the city was forced to give money back. They literally
umbrella of credibility mm-hmm. that we're seeing dissolve, you mm-hmm. know, and you know, I think that we need to spend some time, Judge Gale, talking about what that means on a national level as to what this means to the rule of law. I have to add one more example. Just this week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on the birthright citizenship case. And Justice Amy Coney Barrett, she stepped in to chastise the government's Solicitor General for dismissing a question from Justice Sotomayor. Basically, he was misleading the court, and he was called on it by Justice Barrett. You know, it's from top to bottom, it seems, with this Justice Department. And what's that going to do with the rule of law?
Well, I'd also say that it almost tracks with other behavior we've seen, right? So in the Abrego-Garcia case, and I believe the judge in that matter very early on made it clear that she was confused as to why the government had not made more and been more proactive in returning Mr. Garcia, especially in light of their admission of his deportation being a mistake. And instead, it appeared that the government's response to the judge was essentially, mind your own business. This is the executive branch. We do what we want, and you don't tell us what to do. And I'm not suggesting that's the exact language that was used. It wasn't, but it at least appeared to be kind of the tone of the response to the court. And that, I'll tell you in and of itself, was absolutely incredible to me. I had never before, I couldn't have dreamed of responding to a court's order essentially to say, that says, hey, explain to me why you guys haven't done this and tell me what steps you have taken or plan to take to ameliorate this situation. And the response being, judge, dear judge, mind your business. Have a good day. And that's essentially what it sounded like. And I was just sort of had a clutch to
pearls
moment.
Get out of our business.
Right. You know, dear judge, stay in your lane. Have a good day. And being done with it, I could not imagine that ever being a response. So when you talk about being, you know, kind of dismissive of Justice Sotomayor, or, you know, failing to acknowledge a query during a Supreme Court oral argument, and you know, for which these things, you know, it's kind of a foregone conclusion that if a justice asks you a question, and it doesn't matter. I mean, we've been very clear, even on these podcasts, how we feel about the behavior of certain justices, whether it's Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, Justice Roberts. It, you know, nonetheless, were we ever before them in an oral argument setting, I don't know that I could ever imagine not responding.
Or
any, you know, any concern that they raise relative to, you know, the matter for which I'm appearing. And so that's why I think, you know, people are still having clutch the pearls moments, but I'm still saying, well, heck, this seems to track with, you know, what's happened at the trial court level. What you're seeing at the Supreme Court level is kind of, you know, that's, you know, that's nothing.
It's systemic.
It's nothing compared to, you know, what's happening at the trial court level, where literally if you read some of the responses and you read some of the things that have been said to judges at the federal level, it's like, we don't have to listen to you. You know, it's we'll let you know when we like your rulings and when we decide that we're going to follow them. But I think, you know, to your point, even about, you know, the most recent oral argument, I want to say it was Attorney Sowers who indicated that the DOJ has clearly said, yes, they do intend, and I think this might have been in response to Justice Coney Barrett, they absolutely intend to decide and to digest certain court opinions and decide which ones they will adhere to and which ones they will essentially ignore.
And that's going to bring us to a monster constitutional crisis that we'll address later on. But that's what's going to happen. I agree with you 100%.
Indeed. And so brazenly and essentially telegraph that to the justices, to their faces, not in a brief, but as a function of the oral arguments, is, I think, just a different level of engagement that I'd never imagined being alive to see. And I think I'm pretty young. So if I didn't think I'd be alive to see it, then my goodness, we are light years ahead of ourselves, folks, and buckle up.
So in summary, attorneys can be disciplined. They can be disbarred. They can be found in contempt. We're seeing a erosion, it's probably a polite word, maybe an avalanche of the credibility going downhill with judges across the country at multiple levels. And the ultimate issue is going to be, what will all of this mean to the rule of law? And we'll have to wait and see. One quick update I wanted to give you and get a real quick response from Judge Gale. First of all, the Karen Reed trial still going on here in Massachusetts. We've talked about that. The Sean Diddy Combs case going on in New York. They had opening statements in beginning parts of the prosecution's testimony.
Three witnesses so far.
Yep. We will be following both of those cases coming up. But to give you an update on another one, we talked about Judge Hannah Dugan, the Milwaukee County judge that was indicted since our podcast came out. The federal grand jury returned an indictment. Remember, that just means they found probable cause. Accusing her of obstructing an official proceeding and concealing a person from arrest, the gentleman that was in her courtroom that she allowed his attorney to go out through a private jury door into a public area. The update is she pleaded not guilty just this week to those charges. But interestingly enough, Judge Gale, her attorney filed a motion seeking to dismiss the case, arguing that she is immune from prosecution for action she took as a judge in and around her courtroom. And they cited U.S. versus Donald Trump, the immunity case of the U.S. Supreme Court, saying that Trump was immune from prosecution, or president is immune from prosecution for official acts. I don't know where that's going to go, but it's going to be an interesting argument to watch.
And I would say, in the words of MasterCard, priceless.
Hoisted on your own petard, right?
That's all I know.
All right, Judge, how do people find us?
Well, we invite you to check us out anywhere you find your favorite podcast. First and foremost, we thank you for your continued and enduring support of our primary supporter. That is NPR, National Public Radio. So check us out on NPR. But if you also like to grab your podcast from other platforms, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or again, any place else where you get your favorite podcast. We are so grateful that you continue to tune into Next Witness, Please, because we believe that you don't trust what you don't understand. And our hope genuinely is that by extending and broadening your understanding, that you will learn to trust the system all the more. And so we thank you, and we hope that you'll tune in for the latest episodes.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can always email that to me. My email address is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics you would like for us to cover in the future, shoot me an email and we'll add your topic to our list. We so far have addressed several that listeners have asked us to address, and so we'll put yours on the list as well. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law and update you on all the cases we've been following. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.